Welcome to LabCorp Perspectives Oncology, where we connect on cancer, science, and patient care. I'm your host, Dr. Rebecca Previs, and I'm a Director of Medical Affairs here at LabCorp. With me today is my colleague, Dr. Michelle Green, who's also on our Medical Affairs team here at LabCorp and is the Senior Manager of our Oncology Genomics Program. Michelle, I'm so happy that you're here with us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Now, our oncology LabCorp team just got back from the annual ASCO meeting in Chicago, and I think you'll agree it was fantastic. We were so busy, and there were so many exciting studies presented. I'd love to hear it from you, Michelle. You know, what was your overall experience at ASCO? Any highlights that stood out?
Yeah, I mean, ASCO is such a big, exciting meeting where we get to see the latest and greatest in oncology patient care. You know, and I think it's equal parts exhilarating and exhausting. And this is my first year presenting a poster, two posters, in fact. So that was a really great experience to have. And our posters had really great traffic, especially our HER2 poster.
Yeah, congrats to you and the study team. Let's touch on your study a little bit. So for one of them, you performed a retrospective analysis using a breast cancer cohort and evaluated HER2 expression patterns. I think you evaluated over 30,000 specimens from over 27,000 patients. That's a ton of samples. And if I remember correctly, you found that HER2 expression actually changes in about a third of patients over time.
Yeah, so that was from LabCorp's clinical testing archive. So we do a lot of testing. We had quite a bit of data. But we had a subset of about 1,200 patients that had longitudinal data, so specimens collected at different time points during their cancer journey. And it was among those patients we saw about 30% had changes, most commonly in the HER2 low to HER2 zero or vice versa.
So I know that you got some questions at your poster. Can you share with us what you were getting feedback on?
Oh, yeah. So the most common question I got from people is, you know, they asked, what do you think is causing those changes? Do you think that this is just tumor heterogeneity? Is this some kind of technical thing? Or is this maybe a response to treatment? And, you know, I think it could be all three, right?
Probably.
I suspect that's what's going on, is that it's a combination of all three of those factors. But our data also reproduce what other groups have seen. So I think that gives us high confidence that this phenomenon is real.
Yeah, we know it's never one thing, especially when cancer is involved. And that HER2 expression changes over time, like so many other of the biomarkers that we test for. And I think really underscores the importance of retesting our patient's tumor at the time of recurrence or progression. But, you know, HER2 came up a lot this year, not just in your poster.
Yeah, absolutely. HER2 was a very popular subject this year. One of the key studies, which was presented as a late-breaking abstract in breast cancer, was an interim analysis from the DESTINY-Breast09 trial. So this trial was testing trastuzumab deruxtecan with pertuzumab versus a current standard of care, which is a taxane with trastuzumab and pertuzumab, frontline treatment of patients with HER2-positive breast cancer. So, you know, trastuzumab deruxtecan is already used in later lines, and this was asking, would it be beneficial if patients got it earlier? And initial results were very promising. There was progression-free survival improvement and a 44% reduction in risk of progression or death.
That's exciting. And I think we can both agree that trastuzumab deruxtecan and pertuzumab will undoubtedly become the new standard of care regimen for these patients in the first line setting with HER2 positive tumors and have metastatic disease. But there's so many practical questions that this study brings up. Do we need to escalate this for everyone? Are there clinical factors that we can use to really distinguish which patients are going to derive the most benefit? And then what about duration of therapy? All the patients here got trastuzumab deruxtecan and pertuzumab, but is it possible that we could use some type of induction therapy or maintenance treatment? I think we have a lot to learn in this space. But speaking of HER2 again, there are also a lot of drugs in development that we heard about at ASCO targeting both HER2 and HER3. And I know this is an area of interest for you. So what are some of those key takeaways in these studies?
Yeah, maybe a little background here would be helpful first. So the epidermal growth factor receptor family has some very famous classically studied oncogenes. So HER2, which is overexpressed in the subset of breast cancers, usually through amplification of the gene. And then EGFR, which is mutated in a subset of non-small cell lung cancer patients. But there's also two other family members that maybe don't get as much attention, one of which is HER3, and then there's ERBB4. And this family of proteins, they function as heterodimers. So one family member binds to another family member, and then that's the active complex. And in breast cancer, HER2 binds with HER3, but in lung cancer, it's more commonly EGFR and HER3. So what's really cool about targeting HER3 is that you might be able to target both of those cancers with different oncogenes with the same drug. And that's exactly what we saw happen with peritonib deruxtecan, also called HER3-DXd, which is an antibody drug conjugate that's targeting HER3.
Yeah, this is so exciting. And I love how you always bring us back to the cancer biology, which is just so important. So, what about the trials going on in this space? Can you share some of those?
Yeah, so there's been, data published previously, but at this ASCO, we saw results from the HERTHENA-Lung02 study, which was testing this HER3-DXd and EGFR mutant lung cancer patients after they progressed on a third-generation TKI, which is most commonly osimertinib. And those results were positive from this was a phase two trial. And then another trial that I thought was really interesting, really great to see positive results from, was the Tuxedo-3 trial. This was another phase two trial testing HER3-DXd in patients who had brain metastases from either breast or lung cancer or leptomeningeal disease from other solid tumors. And it was great to see early signs of efficacy in that setting because those are really hard to treat tumors.
Absolutely. So let's switch gears a little bit and talk about the science around liquid biopsy. I think it was such a pervasive theme throughout the meeting. It was almost talked about in every disease site and every session I attended. And this includes MRD, response monitoring, NGS, and mutation detection, all via liquid biopsy.
Oh, yeah. So ctDNA monitoring is really hot right now. But I think the thing that came closest to prime time, like closest to ready for use in the clinic, were actually the results from SERENA-6, which was presented during the plenary. And this is a clinical trial testing the efficacy of early switching from aromatase inhibitor plus CDK6 in patients with metastatic breast cancer. So we know in that population of patients, the mechanism of resistance that leads to insensitivity to endocrine therapies, that these patients will gain mutations in the ligand binding domain of ESR1, which makes the estrogen receptor constitutively active, right? So functions in the absence of estrogen. But there's a new class of drugs, selective estrogen receptor degraders or SERDs that are shown to be effective in these patients. So this trial was asking if we monitor for these ESR1 mutations before radiographical progression, can we switch the patient from the AI to the SERD and will that improve their outcomes?
Yeah, and again, like so many clinical questions come up from these exciting data that are presented. How do we translate this to the clinic to start off? How are we going to implement this test practically, clinically? What's the cost of doing serial ctDNA testing in a patient every 2 to 3 months? One thing I always worry about is, are we going to actually induce scan anxiety in patients? Are we delaying progression without really changing that patient's overall survival? So, as a field, I think we're really needing to grapple with answers to some of these questions as we really start to think about how to adopt these liquid biopsy approaches clinically.
That was monitoring for mutations, but there's also a ton of work looking at using ctDNA to monitor response or to look for, I guess, relapse of cancers across all kinds of tumors, breast, colon, gynec, head and neck cancers. There's a lot of emerging data here.
Yeah, I can't resist following all of the GYN oncology plenaries and posters. And I was really lucky to catch the data that was presented about ctDNA MRD monitoring in patients with cervical cancer. This was an exploratory endpoint of the global randomized CALA study where patients with locally advanced cervix cancer received standard of care chemo radiation as well as durvalumab. So blood samples throughout this trial were collected at various time points, and ctDNA was detected in almost 99% of patients at the baseline. And they did see these levels decrease after treatment, with a more significant reduction in patients that received the chemo radiation as well as the durvalumab. But, you know, similar to other studies, baseline MRD levels and molecular response were associated with survival and, you know, helped us think about prognostication.
Yeah, no, this seems to be replicating what we're seeing across tumor types, where the clearance of ctDNA is very, very highly prognostic, is really high value in determining who's going to have better outcomes or worse outcomes. But you know what I really struggle with these trials is, if we think of every other predictive biomarker that we have, so things that we actually use in the clinic, right, to decide what therapy a patient is going to get, all of those biomarkers are not measuring the absence or presence of disease, right? They're telling us something about the biology of the disease. So what I'm struggling with the ctDNA is understanding like how that could be applied when it's not necessarily giving us insight into biology, but rather the presence or absence of disease. So I think it still remains to be seen. You know, I think a lot of clinicians were asking that question, like, how do I get from prognostic to predictive, and how do I bring this into my practice so that I can actually change patient management?
Yeah, I think you said it really well. That's the question, is how do we manage this patient clinically? You know, for patients with a positive result, we don't always have great options or a better option, especially if that patient doesn't have symptoms and they don't have radiographic evidence of disease. I think this is where we have a real opportunity as a field to be more innovative in our clinical trial designs and even develop therapies that we can use and intervene on a patient if he or she has a positive ctDNA result.
Yeah. So let me ask you, if you were designing a trial, you could do anything you want with MRD, what question would you ask, or what would you do?
Oh, this is a really hard question, but I'm going to think really about this opportunity we have to de-escalate therapy in patients who may have been on a maintenance therapy sometimes for years. And specifically, I'm thinking about our patients who go on PARP maintenance therapy or checkpoint blockade maintenance or even an anti-angiogenic. If he or she doesn't have any clinical evidence of disease, and I don't have a scan that shows evidence of measurable disease, and that patient then has a negative ctDNA test, then perhaps we have that kind of final piece of evidence that we need to show that more therapy in these cases isn't beneficial. But that's a big trial with a lot of patients needed across a lot of disease sites, all these patients receiving maintenance therapies.
Oh, but that sounds like a really good use of MRD, right? Because you'd avoid all of the toxicity, right? Like all of the side effects of the drug, all of the extra time and money that goes into treating these patients. And if they don't really need it, that can have like a really big effect for that patient.
Exactly. More time doing things they love, not in the hospital or clinic or infusion center, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I want to highlight the work that you and I both had the privilege of working on with our LabCorp, formerly Invitae genetics teams, where we also had the opportunity to evaluate the concordance between germline genetic testing and those patients that had tumor comprehensive genomic profiling. So for this study, we focused on a cohort of patients with BOP cancer, so breast, ovary, pancreatic, and prostate cancers, to really understand the pathogenic variants that may have been involved in the homologous recombination repair pathway.
Yeah, so this was a really fun study to do and gave us the opportunity to get to work with our new Invitae colleagues. And it was our first effort really to combine data across our organizations. And we came up with a cohort of about 600 patients, and from there narrowed it down, like you said, to patients who had BOP cancers and then pathogenic germline mutations and homologous recombination repair genes. And then we asked if there was anything that else that could be learned from the somatic testing that these patients had. And you know, what we found actually confirms what a lot of other people have seen. We know that sometimes in somatic testing, we might miss a certain percent of mutations found in the germline. In our study, that was about 9%, but that's right in the range of what's been published. And we looked at reasons for this and for this discordance, and it's kind of what you would expect. There are certain mutation types that germline testing's better designed to pick up that aren't going to be picked up by somatic, bigger structural variants or intronic variants, things of that nature. But then also we were asking, you know, what can be gained by combining these tests? And by looking at the somatic test results, we could ask, was there a second hit? Like, is there an extra driver in these tumors? And we did find that was a really common finding in BRCA mutant tumors that wasn't as prevalent as in patients who had other HRR gene mutations.
Yeah, and of course, that take home was exactly what we touched on with Sarah Young about in our first episode, and that was the complementarity of both germline and somatic testing, that really having both allows you to kind of have that full picture of that patient and his or her tumor. But speaking of somatic testing, I do want to do a shout out to Dr. Heidi Koh on our medical affairs team as well. And her poster received a lot of traffic, where she was examining the differences in immune gene expression for KRAS mutated as well as KRAS wild type tumors in patients with advanced pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma. She was really busy and I think surrounded by a crowd for almost the whole 3 hours.
Yeah, it was hard to get a word in with her. She was busy the whole time. But yeah, what her poster showed was that KRAS wild type tumors displayed greater expression of cancer testis antigen, which is a very immunogenic set of proteins that could potentially be targeted therapeutically. And I think the reason why this poster got a lot of positive feedback is that pancreatic tumors, like, there's not great treatment options. So doing this type of analysis and learning more about the tumor microenvironment, it could be really impactful in developing new therapies for this very hard to treat cancer.
Yeah, I agree. Exactly what you said. Really, her study highlighted how we as a field need to think about these novel treatment strategies that perhaps we target the immune microenvironment, and maybe that's with adoptive cell therapies or maybe cancer vaccines to come up with better solutions for these patients. So I also think that you caught the rapid oral session from our other collaborators about natural killer cell transcriptomic expression.
Yeah, this was a really interesting study. So I think most people agree that our current biomarkers predicting response to immunotherapy, like tumor mutational burden and PD-L1 IHC, are pretty imperfect. So they don't have strong associations with response. There's like a lot of patients who are negative for these that still respond. So there's really a need to develop better selection biomarkers for these patients. So in this retrospective study, they performed transcriptomic expression of immune genes, including 52 genes that are markers of natural killer cells. And then they used that to develop a rank score of like high, low. And what the authors found is that patients who got immunotherapy, those with these high NK scores tended to have better outcomes than patients who had low scores, indicating this could potentially be a biomarker that could be developed a little bit more.
Well, we really covered a lot, Michelle, in this short amount of time. I know ASCO was 4 very long days, but we had a blast. Do you have any final thoughts or shout outs before we wrap up our session?
Yeah, it's just that there's a lot to keep our eyes on. And, you know, we'll be looking for new studies in all these areas in the future.
I really appreciate you being here and joining us for this conversation. I'd also like to thank our listeners for joining us. We hope that you'll join us next time on LabCorp Perspectives Oncology.